Welcome to the Ages of Rock podcast with your hosts, Bill Algie, Dennis Talbot, and Alan Tate. We are three guys who have one thing in common, a love of rock and roll. Our goal is to talk about all things rock. We hope you find this show intriguing, funny, and occasionally highly opinionated. Enjoy.
Hey, welcome back to the Ages of Rock podcast. I'm flying solo today, so God help anybody that's on this show, Josie. Anyway, so one of, doing this podcast, we have the ability to get some people on sometimes that are people that we follow personally and really enjoy their music. So Josie Scott is somebody that I have followed for a number of years and seen him a couple of times in concert. He probably remembers. I doubt, really. But we're going to talk about a little bit about that. And it's kind of where he's been for the last little bit of years, and he's back on the scene. So ready to make some new music and get some stuff out there. So Josie, welcome to the show, man.
Man, thanks for having me, brother.
Man, it's been a day.
Yes. It has been a day here too, man.
Yep.
Craziness.
So, yeah, it's been a little crazy. Yeah. So for full disclosure, I kind of scheduled the wrong time and all kinds of stuff. So thanks for being patient, man. I really appreciate it.
But yeah, my pleasure.
Cool. So, I'm trying to think back. I was looking back, and the first time I saw you, it was in Louisville, Kentucky. God, I don't remember when it was. It was at the Kentucky State Fair. Blackstone Cherry opened. That was the first time I ever saw them. The first time I ever saw you guys, too, because it was something I just never could get scheduled to work it out. So,
Was that the show at the baseball field?
It was the show at the baseball field.
I remember that show. Yeah. I remember because we went out later that night to a club called the Rock Bar or something.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And man, I had never seen so many beautiful people in one place in my life. Just the kindest, coolest people, and everybody was having fun and nobody was fighting or raising hell. And it was just kind of heavenly. It was one of those rock and roll nights that you just never forget.
Cool. That's good. I'm just north of Louisville, so we try to catch those shows down there when we can. There's some really cool places to see shows down there. So, but yeah, I took a buddy of mine who'd never heard of Saliva at the time and had no idea. And I'm like, dude, these guys are great. You're gonna love them, whatever. And I remember you walked out, you had pinstripe pants on, wingtip shoes. And it's funny. I remember that from the skateboard, and the guy's like, my buddy's like, are you serious? I was like, this guy's going to kick your ass. we were literally on the third row, and you did a great job, man. It was freaking awesome.
Thank you. Those guys in Blackstone Cherry are always the sweetest guys. And we always had the best time with them. They're good old Southern boys. And always were just the most kindly mannered, good old boys. You know, they always had some good Southern cooking, some good Southern food going on, and they're just the nicest fellas, you know. And man, that drummer, he's just a pleasure to watch. He's like watching, you know, I don't know. He's like watching a dynamo behind the kit. He's just like watching a tornado.
Yeah, so it was I saw them again not long ago, maybe 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They were on a triple bill, and I can't remember who the headliner was, but they did a great job. It was I really actually went to see them. That was my main reason to go. But they did a really good job then too. I've actually seen them twice since then, so that was pretty cool. So you're a Southern boy too, right? So you're right from Memphis, is that correct?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Memphis, and I was actually born in the same hospital that Elvis was pronounced dead in, Baptist Hospital. They've torn it down since then, since I was born, and Elvis died there. I think they tore it down in like 2015 or something. But yeah, it's not even there anymore. Wow. And so me and my wife got married at Graceland.
Really? That's pretty cool.
Yeah, we're big Elvis fans.
Talk about that. How did that? So can you do that? You can like reserve a spot or?
Well, we didn't know we could do that. We met at a show in here in Tulsa at a place called the Voodoo Room, and we dated for about a year, and then we were like, we have the coolest relationship. We don't ever have to get married. Screw all those idiots that get married and blah blah blah. And then I ended up proposing to her one night, and I was, so we decided to get married, and we're just, in love with each other, and like teenagers, we've always been like Romeo and Juliet, just crazy about each other. And we were going to get married at a golf course, and this Grammy event, the Memphis Grammys, were coming up. They have like a local version of the Grammys that they have every year, and we went to this. I invited her to go to this Grammy event with me, since she was my fiance, and we got all fancy, dressed up, and got all gussied up, as we say in the South. And we went to this Grammy event, and there was all these, big time legends there. It was like Ike Turner was there.
Wow.
And Scotty Moore, Elvis's guitar player, was there. And DJ Fontana, Elvis's original drummer, was there. And we got to talking backstage, and we were telling Scotty Moore and DJ Fontana how we were getting married pretty soon, down at this golf course in a place called Pickwick Lake down in the Tennessee River. And he goes, "Well, man," he goes, "y'all are big Elvis fans." He goes, DJ Fontana said, "Why don't y'all just get married at Elvis's house?" And I was like, "What?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "They got a little thing called the chapel in the woods. And it's right out the front door of Graceland, right there on the grounds, right there in the front yard. Basically, they built a little chapel that holds about 150, 200 people. And I was like, "You got to be kidding me." He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I'll set it up for you." He goes, "You just give them a call over there, and we'll have them take a meeting with you guys and see if you want to take a tour and if you're interested in doing it." And I said, "Man, I don't need a tour." I said, "I've had a tour. I'm in." And so we went and looked at the place, and it was just perfect. And we started planning our wedding there, and we ended up getting married at Graceland.
Wow. How do you turn that down? There's no way to turn that down. It was like, yes.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Wow, and, that's incredible.
One of the coolest things that happened was the night before, we had like a gentleman's toast type thing up at the house. And my guitar player at the time, Chris DiBaldo, knew this girl that ran the place. Her name was Angie. We grew up with her, and she started out as a tour guide there at Graceland and ended up running the place. She was like the second in command to Lisa Marie.
Wow.
And so she invited us up there to do this gentleman's toast thing. And we were up there in the front living room of Graceland, and we were looking in Elvis's coat closet. She said, "Go ahead and open that coat closet and look in there." And she said, "That's the same way Elvis left it when he died." And so we opened up the coat closet, and there's like his army helmet was in there. His army jacket was in there. There was some board games in there. And then up in the top of the closet, there was a set of billiard balls that went.
Oh, you froze.
To the pool table, billiard balls down. And he picked up the 8-ball, and he goes, "This is for you, Elvis." And he goes and held it up. And I am not fooling with you. The freaking lights clicked off and on.
Oh shit.
When he did that. In the entire house in Graceland. After he kissed that 8-ball, he goes, "This is for you, E." And it goes,
oh man.
It was awesome.
Holy crap.
Isn't that pretty cool?
That is wicked cool, man.
And what was so funny is the girl Angie goes, "Oh, you just had an Elvis moment," and we all looked at each other like, "An Elvis moment? What's that?" And she goes, "Oh, it happens all the time. These little things happen all the time where you can feel his spirit, and he's just, you know, some ghostly in Graceland."
Yeah, I've heard about the ghost of Elvis before, but yeah, that's pretty wicked, man. So I keep telling my wife I want to go to Vegas. We just celebrated our 35th anniversary. And,
congratulations!
I want to go to Vegas and get married in the Kiss room there. They have a Kiss room. You get married by Gene Simmons. I think it'd be kind of cool to get that done. Not by the real Gene Simmons, of course. And she's like, "That's never going to happen." I just want to do it for selfish reasons, but getting married to Grayson's pretty damn cool, though. That would be pretty awesome.
so you're a Kiss man.
I am. Yeah,
that's awesome, brother. Kiss is the whole reason I got into rock and roll. When I was a little boy, my dad was a preacher, and we used to, in the 70s, as you know, families used to go have dinner with each other and play a board game or something like that. And the little kids would go run off and play in each other's rooms while the adults were, you know, playing Monopoly or Life or whatever. So I would always run off to this little kid named Kevin Brock. He was my dad's assistant pastor's son, and he was like the black sheep of the family. And
there's always one of those, right?
Yeah, he didn't go to church, and he collected albums, and he had like lava lamps in his room and these big fishnets hanging from his ceiling, and it was just like, if heaven had a room when I was 6 years old, it was this room. And I would go in his room, and he would let me go through his, he had these big wooden album crates from Peaches Records. And he would let me go through his albums, and he had all the Kiss solo albums and Alive One and the first three albums, Dressed to Kill, and all those albums. And I used to sit there and just look at the Destroyer album cover was my favorite.
Oh yeah.
Because it was just so colorful and so vivid. And I remember getting a picture or having a picture of that album cover and taking it to school for career day. And I told the teacher, you know, kids were like, "I want to be a fireman and I want to be a doctor." And when it came my turn, I held up a picture of that album cover and I said, "I want to be this. I don't even know what this is, but I want to be that right there." Whatever this is on Kiss's Destroyer album cover, that's what I want to be when I grow up.
Well, I think you made it.
I sure tried.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about that. So when did you get into the music business? I know that, so you guys got together, what, 96-ish? Is that right?
Yeah, we got together around 1996. I had been in a band since 1992 called Blackbone with some guys around Memphis. And me and Chris DiBaldo were sort of a package deal. He was my rhythm guitar player, and I was his lead singer. And we kind of, around 1995, 90, early 96, we knew that the Blackbone thing was not going to work out. And I told Chris, I said, "Well, I'm just going to start over, man. I'm going to start over and just re-rack everything. And I'm going to pick a new band name, and I'm going to go to all the best bands in Memphis and pick out all the best players I can find. And I'm going to hand pick me a band." And I said, "And I'll bring you, you know, me and you will be a package deal. They'll have to take, if they want you, they'll have to take me. And if they want me, they'll have to take you." So we kind of shook on it. And, after that, I went around and got, Wayne Sweeney, the lead guitar player, who was the best lead guitar player in Memphis for almost two decades before I even got him. He was in a band called TNA that was really big around Memphis and the regional area. They toured Atlanta, Nashville, and everything. And then Paul Crosby, of course, was I got to back up a little bit. Todd Poole, actually, the lead, he was the lead singer of a band called Roxy Blue.
Oh yeah,
that had they had gotten a deal on the Geffen Records with Tom Zutaut, and he was just an incredible songwriter. I'd always wanted to sort of jam with him. Well, he was going to play drums and let me be the singer. So I was like, well, cool, man, you know. So he played drums for a while and wrote songs. And then we eventually got around to I wanted Dave Novotny really bad. He was in a band called Gemini Clan. And he was just the coolest bass player, you know, was an incredible musician and really rocked out on stage and had an incredible stage show. So eventually we ended up with me and Chris D and Todd Poole on drums and Wayne Sweeney on lead guitar and then Dave Novotny on bass. And then for some reason, as we got closer sort of to recording the first album and getting a deal, Todd had to leave the band. And the other drummer I wanted, if not Todd, was Paul Crosby. And his wife was going to make him quit the music industry. And I drove across town in my little crappy car and drove to his wife's house. And I said, hey, if you will trust me with your husband, I said, I promise you I'll get us a record deal. And it just give him one more shot, you know, at the brass ring. And I said, you know, I don't want to be in a band of hometown heroes forever. I want to be in a real worldwide, you know, national act or worldwide global act or whatever. And she was like, okay, he can have one more shot. And I was just, you know, so thankful to get him in the band. And, then once we started writing together, first song we wrote was Dope Ride, and we just immediately started writing great songs. And then I think it was another, after Paul got in the band in, I think, 97, 98, it was another 2 years, and we just kept chugging along, and we put out our little independent album, and we sold about 15,000-20,000 copies, and we were getting some airplay. There was two DJs there in Memphis at 92.9 WMFS, I think was the radio station at the time. They started playing us on the local rock hour or whatever, and then they just started putting us in regular rotation, a couple of our songs. And we had started getting attention from different labels, and we had Brian Coleman come in and want to manage us on a handshake, which was a real blessing. He managed Nickelback and a couple other big Canadian bands, and he didn't have an American band. So and Brian was a real godsend for us. And we had Jim Zumwalt was our lawyer, and we just put together a good team. And we got turned down by every record label there was. We got turned down by Atlantic. We got turned down by Epic. We got turned down by RCA. We got turned down by Interscope. We got turned down by Capitol. Every one of them turned us down. I think twice they did what they call passed. They passed.
Yeah.
And, God, that was heartbreaking to hear those words. My mother told me one time, she said, if I had to suffer the kind of rejection you've suffered, I would mop up the floors at a peep show before. I was like, dang, Mom, that's pretty gross.
That's pretty bad. Holy crap.
But she was, you know, very supportive. And right around that time, I had lost my dad in 1997. And, you know, that was really, really heartbreaking. And around the year 2000, or around late 1999, Island Def Jam just came out of nowhere. And they said, we want to know who in the hell this band is in Memphis, Tennessee, that's getting all this airplay and selling, you know, 10 or 20,000 units all by themselves with no distribution. You know, it was just word of mouth. You know, we would go to the different record stores back when there was a such thing as a record store, and we would put our stuff on the shelf and consign it, you know, to the record stores. And we'd go down on Beale Street, and we used to sit side by side with 666 Mafia. They would be selling rap CDs on one side of the street, and we'd be selling rock CDs on the other side of the street, literally dealing them out of our trunk. And we were making pretty decent money, actually, because we didn't have anybody to pay, you know. So, and I think one mistake that we continually made was we just kissed the record company's asses. I mean, we would just kiss their asses, and they would fly us out to whatever city they were in, and they would put us in some big rehearsal room or some place that they would rent. And then they would stand there with their arms folded and just to tell us we weren't good enough or we weren't what they were looking for. And
do you think it was because they didn't think the music they had heard transferred over to the live version? I mean, or is it just their deaf?
I don't know. I never could figure it out. But when Island Def Jam told us, they said, we'll fly you out to New York. We'll put you guys up in a rehearsals. We'll get one of those big rehearsal stages, and we'll put on a big showcase, and we'll invite all the record label people out to come see y'all. And I remember being on the phone that day, and I said, no. I said, we're not going to do that. I said, I'm not going to bring my band to New York City and have y'all put us up in some nice hotel and take us out to some nice restaurant for dinner. And then for us to play a showcase for you while you guys stand there with your arms folded, just to tell us we're not good enough or we're not what you're looking for. I said, I'm not going to go through that heartbreak again. I said, now, if you want to come to Memphis and come to Beale Street and let me pack the Omni New Daisy with, you know, 1,000 of our most dedicated fans and let me rock that place to the floor with my guys in saliva, I said, and then I will accept your no or yes. And there was this long, like, it felt like an eternity, but I think it was like 30 seconds, 15 seconds of silence on the phone. And this was a call with like me, Brian Coleman, the head of A&R, the other A&R guy, and Lior Cohen, the CEO. So there was like 15 seconds of silence. And then I heard Lior say, okay, we can do this. We can do this. He's this big old Israeli special forces guy.
Oh, wow.
And he goes, Josie, I can do this for you. We will come to Memphis. I was like, yes. So they came to Memphis, and the rest is history, man. They came to the Daisy just like I asked them to. And I sold that place out, and we worked really hard and got 1,000 of our most rabid saliva fans up in there. And we rocked it to the ground. It was a magical night, man. And we just went out there and played the best 12 or 13 songs we could muster up. And the next thing you know, the ball was rolling. And they came back and seen us again. They had already decided to sign us and they came back and seen us again. And then once our lawyer and their lawyer, they went back and forth on a few details for about a month. And then they came back the third time, and that was the signing party. That was the party where we got to actually sign the paperwork. And they took us right after our show, they took us downtown to the Peabody, and they had a private party for us at the Peabody with this special guest, and they wouldn't say who the special guest was. And we were like, I wonder who the special guest is going to be. I wonder who it's going to be. I bet it's going to be one of his artists. And lo and behold, it was Lionel Richie, dude.
Wow. Oh, shit. Wow.
And we were dumbfounded, man. Like, this guy came out on stage with a little B3-like looking piano, and him and his buddy, he had a piano, and they slayed.
Oh yeah.
Just wow. Murdered. Just, and it was just hit number one hit after number one hit after number one hit. And it was just incredible. Another magical night, man.
Man, you've been pretty lucky. You've had some pretty very cool experiences.
I'm sure
I'm sure there's a lot of not cool experiences that have happened to you.
I was going to say, like Abraham Lincoln says, for every yes, I heard 1,000 no's.
Yep, that's for sure. That's really cool. You know, I think that helps some of those bands that really struggled work a little harder and really kind of appreciate it a lot more than some bands that get, you know, signed immediately. You know, all that stuff in the 80s. You know, I'm a big 80s rock guy. You know, there were this cookie cutter band stuff that was happening. You know, everybody sounded the same, and you know, it's like that a little bit now on the radio for sure. What very little radio I listen to.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like that too. But yeah, I think it makes people just really, it makes you hungry. It makes you work harder. That's cool. But that's incredible. Great. That's a great story.
Thank you.
So tell me about, you know, I've been, like I said, I've been a huge Slider fan. I've got everything up to, I've got the thing about CDs. I'd love to have some vinyl, by the way. If you guys ever decide to put that stuff out on vinyl, I am like going to be in debt. So
we're working on that. I'm working on that now with my solo stuff. But I'm working on getting something done right now in vinyl, because I love vinyl too. I love to collect vinyl as well. So
yeah, I got a few. You can probably see them over there.
Nice.
There's about 400 and probably close to 500 now sitting over
there. Oh, you got them all bagged and tagged too.
I got them bagged and tagged, because if I don't, I'm in trouble. If I don't, to be honest, what happens to me is I have an app on my phone, and I'll go somewhere and I'll grab it and start walking around with it. And I'm like, if I don't check to see if I have this, I've done it. I bought like three or four. I got two or three copies of stuff over there, because I don't either have access to internet whenever I'm at a show, you know, at a record show or something like that, and pick something up. And then I've got two copies of something or three copies of something. But at least usually it's two copies of something that's good.
I was going to say, I wonder how many times I've bought Back in Black.
Oh, you know, the only Back in Black album I have is the original one I bought. The original. Wow. Way back in the day. That's the only Back in Black album I've ever bought. So I had gotten rid of all my vinyl at one point in time, except for I kept all my Kiss records, and I kept a few others. And the few others I kept, one of them was Back in Black. And that is one of the few that I have from back in the day.
How old are you, Bill?
I'm 56.
56. So you're 6 years older than me.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's about right. You'd have been, let's see, I was 9 years old in 81.
So I was a freshman in high school. Yeah.
I was going to say you're about 14 or 15. So yeah. See, I'm jealous, man, because you were at the coolest age at the coolest time. I was born too late, man. I was born too late. I wanted to be so much older back then, because I wanted to be old enough to go to Kiss concerts and, you know, go see Queen and all that. And I just wasn't old enough.
But now you do that for your kids, right? So you make sure your kids absolutely. Get to experience that stuff. So, you know,
absolutely.
So I went, my first time I went to see Kiss was on, was January 22nd in 1978.
Oh.
And I went with my dad. It was a Live 2 tour.
Oh, yeah. So jealous.
In Evansville, Indiana, which is not terribly far from us, but that's where we live. And but I've made it a point to take all three of my kids have went the same age I was when I went the first time.
Nice.
And so, it's, you know, I think people that are into music and you included, when you have those moments, mm-hmm. you know, that you can't get away from it. You know, you just can't. And every one of them have had some kind of a special event that's occurred as well. I mean, my middle son, we were in, I know this interview about you, I'll just tell you a quick story, but we're in Chicago, Illinois. I took him, that was his first time to go, was in Chicago at the United Center. We were sitting there and we ended up, because we met some people that were sitting right behind us that worked for A&E when Gene Simmons had his show on A&E, and they invited us to go back and meet Gene.
Wow.
That was his first show. I'm
like,
this
interview
is
not about me, man. This interview is about us, bro. You got the coolest stories, dude. You're the coolest age at the coolest time ever.
But the funny thing was, is the next show I took him to, I'm like, dude, this is never going to happen again. You just don't even. Who do you think we're going to meet? We're meeting nobody. Because that's how it works. That was a one-time deal. But yeah, you know, I think the cool part about music is just it puts you in a special place. And funny, you know, another quick story. I met Gene years later, just a couple of years ago again for another time. And I told him I had a record album I wanted him to sign. I had actually Dressed to Kill, which is one of my favorite early records.
Oh.
And I asked him to sign it, but he signed some pictures, the pictures that were taken of my son and him and I, whenever we met him the first time. And he said, why do you have that piece of crap album? Actually, he said, what's that? Why do you have that piece of shit album? And I said, because I love this record, man. And he goes, no, you don't love that record. Nobody loves records. And I go, no, I love this record. He goes, no, you love the way it makes you feel and where it takes you when you listen to it. But it sounds like shit and you know it. And I'm like,
wow.
I'm like, yeah, that's true. It doesn't sound very because, but it really is all about how it makes you feel, right? And I'm like, yeah, it really is. And I'm telling you, it was one of those moments you sit there and you go, yeah. So I, you know, music, I've got hundreds of CDs over there and, you know, MP3s out the butt. But, you know, I think to your point, it's about those special moments that you create in time. And, you know, it's just really cool. And it's cool. It's great. It's great for me to be able to talk to people about that stuff and have artists on the show that value that and value the fans and stuff like that. So thanks, man.
Yeah, it was like almost like, dude, it was like a baptismal like experience, man. When I first walked into an arena and just hearing the roadies up there testing the kick drum, like, and I could feel it in my chest.
Yeah.
Going, doo, doo, doo. I was like, dude, I was like Matthew McConaughey. I was like, you know, it was an experience. It was a spiritual experience, bro.
Yeah.
I can't put it. And the lights go down and you hear, you know, 15 or 20,000 people scream at one time. Like it takes you, it's otherworldly, man. It takes you to another dimension. And I think that's what music was always meant to do throughout history. I think it was probably like that the first time, you know, all the way back to like the Romans or, you know, Shakespeare, or the first time stringed instruments or horns were played in some kind of, you know, acoustic place that was built to move that sonic sound upwards. I think, you know, I think from that moment on, it was a spiritual experience and was meant to be a spiritual experience. Quincy Jones said one time, when people say they get goosebumps, he calls that God's wand.
Oh, nice. I'll have to remember that.
Isn't that good?
That is good. That is good. So yeah. What's it like being on the other side of that? What's it like being on You know, I've always emulated people like that and wanted to be in that environment. I have no talent at all, but I can't imagine what it's like to be on a stage and have 100 people, let alone thousands of people, when you walk out screaming and mm-hmm. going bananas. Is that just like a God's wand all over you?
Oh yeah. All over you.
Electric.
I mean, it will send a lightning bolt up your spine, man. I mean, there's nothing. I had seen it from the crowd side for so many years, and seeing it from the crowd side made up my mind, man. It just made up my mind. I felt it in my spirit and in my heart and in my soul, in my mind. I felt I have to get on that stage. I have to get on that stage. That's where my freedom is. That's where the answer to all life's problems are, is on that stage. And I think it was, oh man, just the most magical feeling that you could possibly feel sober on this side of heaven or this side of the universe. I think it's the most magical feeling possible. And like Peter Criss said, I think that's why there's unfortunately so many musicians that fall prey to drugs and alcohol and different substances, is because it's a hurry up and wait game, you know. For an hour and a half a day, you get to fly the rocket ship. And then for the other 22 and a half hours of the day,
yeah,
no rocket ship. As a matter of fact, not only is there no rocket ship, but you're crammed into a tin can with 15 other stinky boys going to a place that's 14 hours away. So you're just sitting there going,
yeah, you know, I never thought about it that way. And I've never, that you have to be right. That's gotta be. And I can understand why people, and a lot of people, you know, a lot of artists that, you know, they get, you know, connected with alcohol and drugs and stuff like that. It happens. I can definitely see why, because you get so you that high feels so good. I mean, you know, that natural high feels so good, mm-hmm. you know, being on stage, that when that comes down, it's tough. And I've also right. learned over the last couple of years too, as I have met more artists and stuff like that, that, you know, even guys that are doing tribute bands and stuff like that, because there's some of those guys that I'm friends with, you know, it's tough for them even after the show. They can't come out right after the show. I mean, the guys that are lead singers, they will not come out right after the show, because, you know, a lot of times it's like, you know, doing voice things, stuff like that. They're just exhausted. They've got to get down.
Mm-hmm.
They're so up energy wise. They got to try to get themselves down to a level where it feels normal. And
Fleet,
I didn't really
Fleet. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just didn't really realize that it was that much of an emotional high. So
yeah.
Like, yeah.
Fleetwood Mac had a clause in their contract, and when they would come off stage, they had to be robed in bathrobes and put into a dressing room and the door sealed for 45 minutes. And they could not have any contact besides them. They were sealed in the dressing room by themselves for 45 minutes. And then they would unlock the door and slowly begin to say, hey, are you guys hungry? Do you guys want to go back to the bus? Do you want to go to the plane? Do you want to go home? You know, is everybody ready to go? They didn't want to talk or be messed with for 45 minutes after the show. So that definitely speaks to your point that it is like you have to come down.
Yeah.
You know, because your heart's beating out of your body. You are exhausted. Your clothes are soaked. I've never soaked my clothes besides swimming. I've never totally soaked my clothes through and through like I do on stage. And you really do have to, I mean, I've even had to come off stage and take a couple of pulls off an oxygen mask just to get my breath. And then, you know, let my heart stop beating out of my body. And then you just sort of collapse into yourself for a minute. And it certainly is a time when you certainly have to, it's like coming down, it's like climbing up on the mountain like Moses, and you're like, ah! And then you have to come down from the mountain, man. You got to come down from the mountain. And like Peter Chris said, that's, I truly believe that that's where a lot of artists get caught up, is they don't want to come down from the mountain.
It feels too good.
It feels too good.
Yeah.
And, but the lie that drugs and alcohol tell you is, oh, well, I'll make you feel like that. Not just like that, but kind of like that for this long until you get to the next show. And then you get to the next show and you're like, oh, well, I've been up since the last show and I got to keep on going till the next show. So I got to do another show, you know, and it you just get caught in that vicious cycle. And before you know it, you're under the wheels of the bus, literally, pun intended, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I want to be respectful of your time. So I want to talk about some saliva music and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. Talk to me about, I'll tell you another quick funny story. So the only time I've ever done karaoke mm-hmm. was, I work at a hospital. So it was at a department.
Oh, that's awesome.
Department Christmas party. Right. And we had karaoke. So they're like, who wants to do what? So I pick Click, Click, Boom. All right.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to awesome. Do this. Right. So okay. The alcohol told me I could do this. The reality was not a chance in hell. Okay. So it was at a Holiday Inn, which just is very ironic, by the way. So I'm up there, I'm starting the rap at the beginning or whatever. All of a sudden I'm like to the first refrain and the fire alarms go off and they shut the joint down.
No way.
Swear to God. I have never done karaoke since. I will not do it. I can't do it.
That's like, awesome.
Like, you want to do karaoke? I'm like, nope. Doesn't matter. It's not going to happen.
That's awesome.
So that's the only time I've ever done it, and it was horrible.
I tell you what, Click, Click, Boom's a mouthful, man.
It was way more than I had expected. One thing to sing along in the car, another thing to do it in front of a few people, literally.
Right.
So are there, what is your favorite song to perform? Is Click, Click, Boom one of your big, is that one of your favorites to perform, or is there other things that you really,
you know, enjoy? What? I hate to sound typical like most musicians, but I love them all, man. You know, there's something special about every one of them. They're truly like your children, you know. They're always born in a special way. They're always raised in a special way. They're named in a special way. It's just like a child, you know. You love it and you raise it and you nurture it and you send it out into the world and you pray that the world doesn't hate it.
Yeah. No kidding.
But, Click, Click, Boom, is certainly one of my favorites. Because I sing it from the point of view of the abused woman instead of the man, is very special to me. Ladies and Gentlemen is very special because it's sang as if I'm a circus, ringmaster of the circus. And I used to be fascinated with the ringmasters of the circus and just the circus in general. And rock and roll, as you know, is like running away to join the circus.
Yeah.
And just every one of them, you know, are special in a different way. You know, like even deep cuts, like Famous Monsters is a tribute to Lane Staley and sort of how heartbroken I was over that situation. I actually got to sing on stage with him back before we got signed at a little bar in Memphis called Rascals. They came there after a concert with Van Halen, and I got to actually get on stage with Lane and do It Ain't Like That. And that was just a magical moment for me. And he was just such a special singer and such an amazing band. And I sort of tried to encapsulate that moment in Famous Monsters. So it's special because of that reason. Yeah, all of them are special.
Cool. Yeah, I wrote down it. So a couple of mine that are big favorites. Dope Ride is a song that for me, we had an episode on, it was like things you turn up to 11, you know, when you're in the car. And actually I'd forgotten, I'd read through so many, I mean, there were so many songs. And then I've been listening since, you know, I kind of connected with you the other day. I've been listening to stuff, you know, in the car and stuff like that, just to kind of, you know, it's been a little while. And, man, that came on the other day. I was like, oh shit. I cranked that thing. I was like, if anybody around me can hear it, you're getting some education today, kids. So,
well, I've always loved that one. Like I said earlier, because that's the first song we ever wrote with Paul. And Paul's just such a special drummer and a special guy. He's an amazing musician and an amazing entertainer and an amazing father. And he's even has his own management company now where he manages bands, and he's just motivated, you know, out the wazoo, and just so creative. You know, he's always been like a multi-level creative type guy, you know, not just a Grammy nominated drummer, but an incredible songwriter and a really great manager of young talent, a great cultivator of young talent. He knows how to get the best out of young people that are trying to make a career in this business. And so Dope Ride is a special moment because that's the first song I ever got to write with him. And it was a dream to be in a band with him because I sort of had to fight for him, you know, because of his old lady was going to make him quit the biz. There's a breakdown in Dope Ride where we kind of where I kind of mess with the crowd during the breakdown, and I get them to sing you know, parts of like Shout by Tears for Fears and I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett, and I get to have like a Freddie Mercury moment where I sing and they sing, you know, and
response.
Call and response. Yeah, it's tight moments, and so that's a total, and it's just an ass kicker, you know.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the beginning of it, just, you know, you get that sounds like electric drum kind of thing going on at the very beginning, and then when it kicks in, it's like, oh shit, it's on,
right? Yeah,
I mean, it's just a great song,
definitely.
Yeah, and another one for me is Rest in Pieces. That's another song it's a beautiful song. Just it's really cool. But
now that one was special because Nikki Sixx has always been my idol, like just always been an idol of mine. And he wrote that song for us with his partner, John Michael, his partner in 6 a.m. And that was one of the first songs that they wrote together. And it was sort of the beginning of their writing partnership. So that song's special because of that reason. And we were playing Tulsa, Oklahoma, and our tour manager woke us up on the bus, and he goes, guys, if Scotty Ross, the famous tour manager of, like, he managed like Journey and Poison and Van Halen in their heyday and all these famous bands. So he's like this big time tour manager, and he's sweet as he can be. He's like a father to us. And he woke us up that day and he goes, guys, you got to get up. Everybody's got to get up. You got to go in and you guys got to sound check today. And we were like, Why do we have to sound check? We never sound check. We sound checked at the beginning of the tour and we know all the sounds are right and it's going to be fine. He's like, nope, you got to get up because you got to go in here. And the radio station guy told me they're playing Rest in Pieces on the radio. And I know you guys haven't played it since you recorded it 6 months ago. So you got to go inside and practice that song. So we went inside to practice playing Rest in Pieces because we literally hadn't played it for the last 6 months since we recorded it. So wow. Being the intelligent father that he was to us, he knew that we were going to have to get up and go learn that song. And because I got up and went in and was sound checking, my wife walked in.
There you go.
And I spotted her and my life was never the same.
Fate. Absolutely. 18
years later, we have three beautiful children, and the rest is history.
Cool. So you've been out of the limelight for a little bit with Saliva, but you've got to get some what is it? The Blue Ridge Rock Fest coming up in September.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how did that come about with you going back? Is that just a one off thing?
Yeah, it's just a one off thing. I'm gonna come. Join the guys for the half a set for the first encore. I'm going to come out and do three or four of the hits with them at Blue Ridge, and it's going to be exciting, man. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait.
I wish it was closer. I'm in Indiana. It's a little far away.
Oh, I was going to tell you, my mom is from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's a good. I'm from just south of Indianapolis, so
okay,
is where I'm at. So not too far. But if you're in the neck, if you get out in this neck of the woods, so you got any other stuff planning? I mean, are you got a new album coming out? You're working on, or
I'm working on a new album right now. I got the first single done. It's called Evel Knievel, and it's you're gonna love it. It's an ass kicker.
Cool.
I wish I could play some of it for you, but I'm still waiting on to get the mixes finalized and everything on that, but it should be out around September. I'm gonna try to get it out around the Blue Ridge thing, and try to get a solo record out soon after that.
Cool. So you have a band for the solo record, or are you doing all, everything? You got a band?
Yeah, I have a band, and cool. I'm gonna I got to finish up the rest of the songs, and I've been doing a lot of stuff. I did a couple songs with Struggle Jennings in the studio. I'm doing a song with a band called Silent Theory. In the studio right now. I'm doing a lot of guest appearances, stuff like that, just kind of getting my feet wet because I took, 10 years off, and I became a peer recovery support specialist, and I've been working with people that are like underprivileged people that are trying to get into rehab and trying to get cleaned up, and working with veterans that are trying to get into rehab and get cleaned up, and the homeless and different things like that here in Oklahoma, and it's been so gratifying, man, to be able to help people like that. And I go and speak at different meetings, and just able to, it's one thing to be able to touch people's lives with music, but I've never been able to touch people's lives with my story, and that's a whole other level of being able to touch people's souls, mm-hmm. and really help to change their lives for the better, hopefully.
Cool, man. Thank you very much for doing that. I mean, it takes somebody special to go out there and put themselves out there to do that kind of work, because it's not an easy job.
Pleasure.
It's not easy work, for sure. Well, man, I want to be respectful of your time. We could talk for probably another 2 hours is what I'm guessing.
appreciate you taking the time with me, Bill.
Yeah. So you're going to tell some folks where they can find more about Josie Scott?
Yeah. Just check me out at josiescott.com is my website. And you can also get me on Twitter at Josie Scott Music. And I'm also on Instagram at Josie Scott. And yeah, just reach out. I'd love to talk with the fans, and I'd be glad to talk with you, Bill, anytime you want to holler at me.
Cool. All right. Well, hang on for just a second. I'm going to take us out of here, and then we can chat for a second.
You got it, brother.
Hey, Josie, thanks for being on the show, man. It's been a pleasure for me. It's something I've wanted to do for a long time, so I'm glad you responded. So thanks a lot. Hope you guys enjoyed the interview. Not an interview, discussion. I think it was a discussion. And you know where to find us. We're on all the podcast stuff that you can find in YouTube and all that kind of crap. So check us out on there. And until next time, peace out.
Thanks for listening to the Ages of Rock podcast. If you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, and most importantly, tell all your friends. Remember, you're never too old to rock. Until the next episode, peace out, folks.